The Guardian.
A very warm welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Charles Arthur. This week on the show,
we never tried to, you know, disrupt anyone's business model or take them out of business, but rather figure out ways that we can make that workflow a bit easier.
I meet Victor Henning, co-founder of Mendeley, the academic research and collaboration portal that's changing the way scientists swap big ideas. And
I fell into a pattern recognition trap. I was looking for faces in the clouds. I was delegating my human psychology to the magic machine.
In her latest email from abroad, Alex Krotowski muses on the very distinct experience of travelling the globe being directed by Google Now. And we'll have a roundup of this week's news, including Google's run-in with the US Federal Trade Commission over its purchase of the traffic mapping app Waze, and why the Glastonbury Music Festival is getting excited about Wi-Fi eco tractors. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, if Facebook has perfected the social network, LinkedIn the professional network, then Mendeley could surely lay claim to the top spot when it comes to academic networks. The London-based startup was founded in 2007 and within a year had its research paper management and exchange network in beta. Key to its success is widespread adoption by the academic community, but its reach has spread. To tell me more about Mendeley's growing ambitions, I spoke to co-founder Victor Henning, and I began by asking him how the company got started. Welcome, Victor. Mendeley is a London-based startup, and you've achieved the what many startups want to achieve, which is the exit, so-called. You've been bought by Reed Elsevier. But just give us a rundown on how it went before this. You were founded in 2007. What was the purpose of Mendeley when you started it?
That's right. The idea for Mendeley goes back even further. I had it along with my co-founder, Jan, when we were both PhD students in 2005. And we were both struggling with managing academic documents and collaborating with other researchers in different universities. And we thought there had to be a better way of managing those documents by automatically extracting all the relevant information that you needed from those documents, author, title, volume, journal, issue, etc., and turning it into a structured database that you could read and search and annotate, and which would then allow you to share those documents with other academics more easily. That was the idea. In 2007, we took our savings, gave them to a Belarusian outsourcing company to develop a prototype, which we then used to raise funding from Stefan Glänzer, who at the time was the chairman and first investor of Last.fm, the big online music service. And we pitched him with an idea for a Last.fm of research, which was about scrubbing academic research data, putting it all into a big anonymized database, and also doing interesting things with that research data, like tracking global research trends. And so we moved to London in 2008, built the company from there, and as you mentioned, were acquired by Reed Elsevier last month, pretty much exactly 5 years after we launched the first beta.
So it sounds like what you're building initially sounds a bit like the citation index, the scientific idea of which papers get cited most, which was actually behind the whole idea of Google, which is, you know, which pages point to each other the most. That was something which grew out of the idea that Larry Page and Sergey Brin thought about of the whole citation index thing. So what was your new wrinkle on that?
Yeah. The new idea was that instead of having a central crawler like Google, or, you know, the other citation indexes owned by Thomson Reuters and Elsevier, in fact, were centrally curated indexes which depended on people just ingesting content. And the new idea that we had was to crowdsource it all. So we thought if we could get hundreds of thousands or even millions of scientists to use our software to extract this information, each document in our database would come with a layer of social information. So who are the scientists that are interested in this particular piece of research? What are the papers that are being read this week by, you know, bioinformaticians or physicists or doctors? And we could then stratify that data by whether they are undergraduates or PhD students or postdocs, where in the world they are, and most interestingly, what else they're doing at the same time. So you can introduce this idea of collaborative filtering. Like Amazon's, people who have bought this book have also bought that book. We could then say, you know, researchers like you who have read these papers are also interested in those papers, so maybe they're interesting for you as well.
So for every startup story where there's the sort of successful purchase or the successful IPO indeed, it always seems like it's a sort of a natural progression, but that's actually never the truth. There's always obstacles to be overcome. What were the key obstacles you had to overcome?
a ton of them. It was the typical startup roller coaster. So from one day when you're on top of the world, you've just won. I remember, I think it was in early 2009, we'd gone to our very first startup pitching competition in Brussels called Plug, and very unexpectedly won it. And so had this title, you know, Startup of the Year. And then I think just shortly after, one of our best engineers was poached by Facebook. And if we didn't get a replacement, within the next 4 weeks, the whole service would collapse. And so you have these ups and downs constantly of, you know, getting new rounds of funding, but then the round of funding being attached to conditions that you weren't necessarily happy with, losing employees, copyright issues, cease and desist notices that you had to deal with, all the way through the acquisition, where until the very day that we signed the papers, we didn't know whether it was actually going to happen.
So what advice would you give to someone who's in the startup throes, who is sort of feeling as though the problems are insuperable and yet feels that what they're doing is something that has to happen because it's got such inherent value? How should they cope with those challenges?
There's a great article called How Not to Die by Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, the iconic Silicon Valley seed incubator. And in How Not to Die, he basically talks about how everyone goes through that pain of running a startup. And if you make yourself aware that everyone, no matter how successful, goes through it, it somehow becomes less painful. And for me, I always felt that the fact that I was dealing with an idea that, you know, now 8 years later still fascinates me, kept me going, because I felt even if the whole thing goes bust and collapses, at least I feel like I've spent my years doing something worthwhile, you know, trying to make research more efficient and help academics in their daily lives. So having a good idea that keeps you going. Second, I think co-founders are also a really important thing. Most of the failed startups that I've seen were because the co-founders didn't get along, fought turf battles, had egos. And in our case, Jan, Paul, and I had been friends before we started the company, and during the company actually solidified the friendship because we were always there to help each other out and back each other up, like through the lows. And that was really important to making it through those, you know, troughs of despair.
So looking at Mendeley itself and the objectives that you had about being able to show scientists what sort of things were happening, you know, scientists are reading about bioinformatics or also reading about mimetics or whatever. Can you sort of point to things where you can say, we actually had an impact? We made this happen. We made this piece of research happen.
It's hard to say, because I think mainly what we're doing is we're helping individuals discover new things. And even though we do get cited a lot, and if you look at Twitter, you see people saying Mendeley, just last night I saw one saying, Mendeley is the greatest source of happiness a scientist can find, and it's free. It's difficult to pinpoint, you know, individual breakthroughs, because they're still done by the scientists themselves. We just like to think that we make the process a bit easier, and we help people find content and other academics that are, you know, of interest.
So in the past couple of years, there's been a big move towards open access for scientific papers, for papers which are done within universities, publicly funded organisations, to be made available for free for anyone to read. In effect, sort of arguing that because our taxes are paid for it, therefore we should be able to read them for free. And as you said, you've been bought by Reed Elsevier, which has had a quite different approach. It's very much the sort of paywalled approach, to journals and so on. Is there a conflict between those two models, and where do you fit into that?
Fortunately, Mendeley has remained fairly independent, so we have our own office, our own staff. And I think Mendeley has always had a fairly neutral approach to the topic, because we knew that we had to work with paywalled, existing, you know, publishing business models, because about 90% of all research is still behind paywalls. And Mendeley's task was to make access to both open access content easier, but also to paywalled content. And so we tried to partner with publishers wherever we could. We never tried to, you know, disrupt anyone's business model or take them out of business, but rather figure out ways that we can make that workflow a bit easier. When it comes to Elsevier, I think you're right that until, you know, a few years ago, that was still the very dominant business model, and it probably still is the dominant business model. But over the past 2 years, I think Elsevier has responded to the very public and harsh criticism they've received and the boycott, which happened last year, by, I think, at last count, more than doubling the number of open access journals they publish and gradually transitioning to a world where it's not just about the content, but also the value out of the service. So Mendeley is just one example of a workflow tool that's part of the Elsevier ecosystem. You also have Scopus, which is one of the biggest academic structured databases, which also provides citation services. You have Clinical Key, which is a semantic search engine for clinicians and psychologists. And so I think more and more of the revenue from publishers will come from these value-added services and from open access. So there's not necessarily a clash between the cultures.
And what about the cultures between Mendeley and Reed Elsevier? I mean, how do you see those melding together? Can they mix together? You said that you're sort of staying fairly separate, I think. And what are they going to keep you at arm's length? Are you this sort of interesting organism that that might grow bigger, might sort of, you know, chug along and grow organically? What's the plan?
Well, they are of course quite different because Elsevier is this publishing company with, you know, 150 years of history. Whereas with Mendeley, I think we've been around for a little more than 5 years. Average age of staff is probably around, you know, 25, 26. And so quite different approaches to product development and I'd say also taking risk and developing new things. And to Elsevier's credit, they've said they recognize that that's what brought us so far and that's what they wanted to get from Mendeley in the future. So to keep us innovating, they've, you know, left us in our separate office. They will actually turn Mendeley into a sort of center of expertise for development. So more and more resources from Elsevier being relocated to our office rather than, you know, vice versa. And we're hiring more development staff. We will gradually take on more infrastructure work for Elsevier as well to introduce our best practices for coding and software development to the company. And my new role in this context is that I've been made Vice President of Strategy at Elsevier, which gives me an amazing opportunity to bring some of the ideas that we've had and the vision we've been pursuing into the wider Elsevier organization. And when I first met Ron Mobed, the CEO of Elsevier, he encouraged me to just, you know, keep going with that vision and keep pushing for it because he felt that that was what was appealing about Mendeley and you know, what we'd built for the past 5 years.
And have you, I mean, you obviously will have received some payment as a result of the buyout. Have other employees at Mendeley, do they have shares which will, I don't know, vest in a few years? Are people locked in for a certain length of time?
We made sure from the beginning when we launched the company that we had an employee option scheme that meant that every employee, regardless of their role, had some share options in the company. And so when the company got acquired, they were immediately able to sell those share options and get a return. And there is additionally a fairly generous package for them to, you know, keep contributing to the company and stay around for the future.
And for yourself, how much money did you make? Let's ask.
I can't tell you that. What I can tell
you
is
enough to make you very comfortable, fairly comfortable. Footballer salary?
No, not footballer salary. I did all right. I bought a new scooter, which, as you know, got stolen the first day I had it. But I fortunately got it back because of a parking ticket.
That's right. It was, as I understand it, it was found in an adjacent road the next day, and it had a parking ticket on it. And this was how you were able to track it down.
Yeah, that was.
And at least this is your story, was that it was in an adjacent road, had been stolen, and that's why I had the parking ticket. Did you manage to get the parking ticket removed as a result?
Yeah, fortunately, they cancelled it because I described the circumstances of my scooter disappearing and vigilant neighbours alerting the police, which interrupted the people that were transporting it into a separate van. And so they dropped it off in the street where I got the parking ticket, and that's how I was able to trace it down.
So it's a win for crowdsourcing all over.
Absolutely.
Victor Henning of Mendeley, thank you very much.
Thanks.
And now here's this week's Technology News Roundup with Jason Phipps.
Instagram has launched a video sharing tool this week in a move that will place the Facebook-owned company in direct competition with Vine, the Twitter-backed video app. Instagram CEO Kevin Systrom made the announcement at Facebook's Menlo Park headquarters in California, promising that Instagram video would incorporate, quote, everything we know and love about Instagram, but it moves. An updated version of Instagram, which was bought by Facebook for a cool $1 billion US in April last year, was made immediately available on iOS and Android. Instagram's popularity was in part based on the special filters users could impose over their pictures. And Instagram Video has similar capabilities, with 13 specially created filters available to process video. One of the benefits Instagram Video will have over Vine is that it already has a dedicated audience. Instagram has an impressive 130 million active users. Vine, which Twitter bought for 30 million, launched as a new app in January this year, with Vine having to build its followers from scratch. The US Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, is investigating Google's $1.3 billion acquisition of the crowdsourced traffic mapping and navigation company Waze, the search company has confirmed to The Guardian this week. The FTC's actions follow demands from consumer groups concerned that the takeover by Google, which already dominates online mapping, notably in the US, could corner the market by absorbing the Israeli startup, which boasted earlier this year its only real competitor was Google. Though the company Waze's revenues are below $70 million, that's the level at which an FTC investigation would automatically be triggered, the watchdog is entitled to investigate any takeover that it thinks could restrict consumer choice. Google said when it announced the Waze purchase earlier this month that it would be keeping Waze as a separate unit, quote, for now. The FTC could also instruct the two companies to remain separate while it carries out the investigation. eMarketer reported this week that the UK mobile advertising market is forecast to almost double in 2013 to £1 billion sterling, as Google, Facebook and Twitter increasingly successfully mine the smartphone, tablet and app revolution. The breakneck growth has been fueled by British consumers' love of devices. Britain has the highest smartphone usage in the world and tablets are now commonplace. Looking ahead, the UK digital ad market will grow to almost 8 billion sterling by 2016, with mobile set to account for 3 billion sterling of that. But to put this in context, in 2011, the Internet Advertising Bureau put mobile ad spend at a relatively paltry 203 million sterling. It is estimated that Facebook UK will make 279 million sterling in total digital ad revenue this year, a 25% year-on-year rise. Within this, mobile advertising accounts for potentially up to half of total digital income. And keeping in mind the British passion for mobile devices, this week festival goers at Glastonbury will be given a hand to keep in touch, thanks to an unlikely piece of farm equipment. One of festival organiser Michael Evis's tractors has been converted into a 4G Wi-Fi hotspot and will be driven around the site at Worthy Farm. The eco-friendly New Holland vehicle has been fitted with network equipment by mobile operator EE, providing high-speed Wi-Fi access to anyone up to 10 metres away. EE will be tweeting the tractor's whereabouts, so anyone who's sober and sensible enough will be able to find it. For all these stories and so much more, just go to guardian.co.uk/tech.
Now, as you know, Alex Kotowski has been a global wanderer for the last few months, and in her latest email from abroad, she discusses the pros and cons of wandering the globe, guided only by Google Now.
Those who've been listening to Tech Weekly for a while now know I have a certain level of resistance to apps and services that can be lumped into the thematic bucket digital serendipity solutions. These are computerized systems that say they can bump you up against something that might just change the course of your life. But full disclosure here, my experience of them has been largely theoretical, because there have been very few of this type that do anything other than put you in the path of random information. Until now. For the last month, I've been on the road around the world, and rather than use my trusty Lonely Planet or Frommer's Guide, I've been letting the internet guide me. I've given myself over to predictive tour guide, Google Now. Google Now is the search engine's serendipity engine. It's their personal digital assistant that, according to the myth, was developed to answer your questions before you even know you have them. The theory goes that the new app will recommend things for you to do and see via your smartphone at the very moment you're ready for them. And these suggestions will be based on where you are, what your search history says you're interested in, how much time your Google Calendar says you have before your next appointment, and other data scraped from your digital universal Google profile, which is how perhaps I was directed on my first night in Auckland, New Zealand, to a local oyster bar. I was raised in the Seafood Hub New Orleans, according to Wikipedia, within walking distance, a mode of transport I invariably select when using Google Maps, with a fine selection of local craft beers. I make it a point to find the local brewery tour in most places I visit, but I didn't know Google knew this. Frequented by young professionals in their 30s. I am. Earlier that day, I'd been to a vegan cafe at Google Now's suggestion, probably because it knew I'd spent time in LA, and there are more vegans there per square inch than grains of sand under their recycled flip-flops. Unsurprisingly, the Oyster Bar was a gastronomic hit. Score one for Google Now. But there was another element that made this experience even more delightful. Over the appetizer, I happened to start a conversation with a couple who were also just stopping through town, dropping off her mum at the airport and catching a comedy gig in the big city before heading back to their farm on the coast 2.5 hours away. Through the briefest of small talk openers, what do you do, etc., we discovered that we had a friend in common. A friend from Canada, who now lives in London. That was weird. Very good, Google Now. A week or so later, I was in another restaurant recommended by Google Now in another town, and I was delighted to discover that they were serving the same bottle of wine I'd almost bought a few weeks earlier when I was in another hemisphere entirely, but hadn't. Coincidence? Well, I was certainly looking for one. It was the beginning of a slippery slope. In the old days, my experience of a place would have been guided by conversations or the options laid out in an index. Now, I was looking at my phone to tell me what was nearby. And why? Because it's my externalized brain. Not a person who can only guess what I might like, or a book that dishes out generic advice to independent backpackers. No, my phone is a simulacra of my interests, my desires, and my timetable. And to ensure a hit, it needed more. And so I migrated my calendar to Google so it would know what my schedule was and where I'd be and with whom. I uploaded information to my advertising profile so it would accurately place me into a demographic silo. I sent emails when I didn't need to, just to get it to pay attention to the keywords I dropped in there. In other words, I fell hook, line, and sinker into its trap. Google Now is a gateway drug to get me to integrate all the loose ends that didn't already belong to the Google panoply. Still, after a while, its recommendations started looking the same. It mostly continued to get me to eat, and eat lots, revealing its relationship with Zagat, the restaurant review bible that it bought in September 2011. I found myself trying to train the thing. I searched for every variation of the words run, running, jogging, to get it to learn that I'd brought my trainers to the other side of the world for a reason, but it never recommended a local route. It only recommended restaurants, and pricey ones at that. I started to lose faith in the machine. I started to question why I should be more than willing to believe a device rather than a non-digital curator of local culture. So, I went to restaurants that weren't recommended by Google Now, and I had a delightful time anyway. I started to use my eyes to navigate the city, rather than keep them glued to Google Maps, to get me to the place that I believed I had to go to have the best experience possible in the few days that I was going to be in a place that I'd never been. I found the end of the yellow brick road, and I could see that this delightful little device was just a man behind a curtain. Google Now is still a work in progress, and the wall that I'm now pressed up against is essentially a feature request. As it currently stands, it's likely that everyone's Google Now experience is overwhelmed by photos of local landmarks and restaurant suggestions, because that's all they've got in their system. Life is more than just exchange rates, weather forecasting, public transport, and entertainment. The good news is that almost every week, they have a new card in their deck. But, like the characters in the role-playing game Deus Ex, Google Now is at an interesting branch in its character path. In that game, the events adapted to the special skills that the player developed. A sharpshooter played Deus Ex like a first-person shooter, while a logical thinker played it like a puzzler. But these simplistic yet divergent paths were laid out by the designers based on the virtual bricks and mortar that they programmed into the relatively closed system. And their boundaries were very strict. So how many parameters can Google Now actually take before its algorithm melts? It's a question faced by all recommendation services. What's the bare minimum of inputs that need to be integrated before its outputs become something useful to the person on a work trip, and someone on vacation, and someone in the office, and someone at home. Google Now's challenge is to work for all of these people, and for everyone else too. My little experiment raised another question. What is the threshold of things a system needs to know about you so that the smoke and mirrors don't dissipate with the gentlest of breezes? What's the bare minimum to give just enough to fool most of us? And whose motivation is that anyway? Unlike the wizard in his mythical land of Oz, Google isn't in the game to fool us, so their task is easier than that, poor guys. They don't want to be magical. We want them to. Which ultimately says more about us and our relationship with technology than Google's intentions with their new toy. Because the terrible truth is that Google could never have predicted the strange coincidences that happened early in my journey. The wine in the cafe in Melbourne, the vegan restaurant in Auckland, the strange connection in the cafe. Yes, they were experiences that were perhaps remarkable to the uncynical eye, but really, each of these things could be explained. Even the mutual friend that I shared with the random Kiwis in the cafe. I fell into a pattern recognition trap. I was looking for faces in the clouds. I was delegating my human psychology to the magic machine. Google Now was laying the seeds for my personal Barnum effect. That delightful psychological trick played by fortune tellers from here to Taiwan. Its recommendations were vague enough to feel personally applicable, especially if I thought it had the answer. One of these days, with enough cards in the pile and the brain power behind it, my Now recommendations will be different from everyone else's, just like my search results currently are. The way it delivers both of these things, however, is science, not magic. It's an algorithm, not a view into my psyche or the fabric of the universe. Now, though, as in the present, I'm going to put my phone down and go for a run without a map to guide me. Crazy as it feels to leave my digital equivalent of Luke Reinhardt's dice in the hotel room, I'm actually delighted. I have no idea what I might discover.
We'll have more emails from Alex in the coming weeks, but if you want to track all her movements and musings, follow her on Twitter at Alex K. That's all we have for you this week, but for breaking technology news night and day, go to guardian.co.uk/technology. But from me, Charles Arthur, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.